grab him from the table today.
Good morning and welcome. It's week three of the legislative session, and please join us on this fantastic voyage that is legislative session. Thank you for joining us on today's Florida League of Cities Monday morning call-in. For those that are new, we'd appreciate it if you'd mute your phone. We're hearing a little bit of background noise, but for those that are new as well, we start the call going around the horn with our lobby team discussing key bills that we're watching and key bills that are moving this week. We also go through where we need your help on the advocacy front. Once the lobbyists have shared their updates, we'll open the call for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, you'll press star 9 at that time. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. We'll send an email summary of the call out later, as well as a link to the recording itself. Please note, it is impossible to cover every single bill that's been filed during a 30-minute call-in, but we will certainly answer questions about bills of interest to you at the tail end of the call. For a comprehensive list of the bills that we're working on, I'd encourage you to go to flcities.com, click on Legislative Bill Summaries under the Advocacy tab. It's about halfway down. You'll see it, flcities.com. Hover your mouth over the Advocacy tab and look for Bill Summaries. So with that as the intro, it's a busy week. Last week was especially busy. There were a number of really big bills up last week, and this week will, I think, prove to be exciting as well. As a reminder, we're on a 48-hour agenda notice deadline, and so that means we won't find out until 5 p.m. today what's up on Wednesday afternoon. So you're going to have to stay close to your devices. We will send out alerts as bills get agendaed, but they are working on a pretty short timeline here, and it's moving fast and furious here in this first month of session. So with that, we're going to go finance and tax. Charles Chapman, tell us what we need to know.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody, and happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone on the call. As Casey mentioned, last week was a big week, and I want to talk a little bit about one bill that we saw move through its first committee last week. That was House Bill 503 by Representative Botana. This is the local business tax bill that we sent an alert out last week. So those of you that engaged on that bill last week, we really want to thank you for your engagement. We are watching two key committees this week. The first is relative to House Bill 503, and that is the House Intergovernmental Affairs Subcommittee. This is the second stop for House Bill 503. They are scheduled to meet on Wednesday at 1 p.m. The agenda for that subcommittee has not posted yet. It will post and be available by 5 o'clock this afternoon. As Casey mentioned, we're on a short turnaround time to get to the Intergovernmental Affairs Subcommittee members. So I would like to ask all of you to reach out to those subcommittee members and please tell them, if you have a local business tax, how important it is to your community, how you use those funds, what is the benefit back to the business community, and overall advocate that the legislature is attacking all of our revenues and making it more expensive for us to provide services. So please do not hear the local business tax bill on the Intergovernmental Affairs Subcommittee agenda this week, or encourage that amendments should be added because the bill is just not good for local governments. The second committee that we're watching is the House Ways and Means Committee. This committee is very important, as all of the property tax reform proposals from stem to stern have a first stop in the House Ways and Means Committee. They are scheduled to meet this Thursday at 11:30 a.m. We will not know what's on that agenda until tomorrow by close of business. So please stay close to your devices so that you will be able to receive any alerts that we may send out. If you do have time this week, please be proactive and reach out to your legislators and help them understand that property taxes means public safety funding. This messaging is resonating with legislators and helping us to fight the fight to keep these bad property tax bills off of agendas and keep them from moving. So please talk about how you use property taxes, but make the correlation for that legislator that any cut and reduction in property taxes would lead to impacts negatively for police, fire, emergency medical, and rescue. And with that, I'll kick it over to David Cruz.
Thank you, Charles. Good morning, everybody. I have three bills to discuss this morning, first of which is going to be a extremely comprehensive growth management bill that will be heard this afternoon in the Senate Community Affairs Committee. This is Senate Bill 1118 by Senator McClain. Senator McClain has filed an amendment to that bill. It's a delete everything amendment, and that barcode number is 632862. So for purposes of discussion, that amendment is going to be the bill. And so my comments are tailored to that amendment. This is a wish list from developer interest groups, essentially asking for various preemptions and definitely some concern to cities here on this bill. Starting off with comprehensive plans, the bill would not allow any city or county to have an optional comprehensive plan amendment that has the effect of lowering density or intensity. Oftentimes, cities adopt this for things like military bases, protection, or protecting historical districts, or even resiliency.
We're getting a lot of background noise on the phone, and if you're walking around or banging pots and pans, if you could please hit the mute button on your phone. We want to make sure that the other listeners can hear what's going on. Thank you, David. Take it back.
Thanks, Casey. So dealing with comprehensive plans, The bill is essentially not allowing you to adopt any optional elements that lower density or intensity. Then it goes ahead and installs a new supermajority voting requirement so that anytime you amend your comprehensive plan and that effect of the amendment has the ability to be more burdensome or restrictive on development rights, your council will now have to pass that comprehensive plan amendment by a supermajority vote. In addition, as it relates to comprehensive plans, the bill creates a new cause of action allowing somebody to bring a lawsuit forward if you reject the amendment that they bring forward, giving them attorney's fees and all, the standard concerns that apply anytime we create a new lawsuit. The bill has provisions dealing with impact fees, essentially making it more difficult for you to raise impact fees, especially if you use the extraordinary circumstance exemption to law. The bill then goes ahead and has several provisions that automatically approve different developments administratively. And this has been an ongoing concern. And this really diminishes voters' rights, their ability to voice concerns, and it completely eliminates your ability as an elected official to vote on any of these matters whenever something is administratively approved. And so here are the two types of projects that would be administratively approved under this bill. An infill development up to 100 acres in size, as long as 50% of that is surrounded by residential, no matter what the current zoning is, no matter what your comprehensive plan says, automatically by right, administratively approved, you could approve up to 100 acres as infill development. Additionally, the bill has language dealing with agricultural enclaves, so up to 700 acres for these. They could be administratively approved. Again, that means no public hearing. And so that's extremely concerning. That would go ahead and preempt any type of zoning. Even if they're zoned agricultural, they would automatically get to be zoned residential to a high density use. And so that is extremely concerning. There's also language dealing with minimum lot sizes, with fuel terminals, with public art. So there's a whole host of issues on here. Like I said before, this is the developer's wish list for all sorts of issues. Their arguments for this bill are primarily that local governments are adopting restrictive elements in their comprehensive plans, making it more difficult for approvals for development in the future, and that they're using data and skewing the comprehensive plans in ways that make it difficult to spur new development. And so this is the developer's wish list, if you will. And that's 4 o'clock this afternoon in Community Affairs. And I'm gonna be real brief on the next couple of bills. Next one up is Senate Bill 1188 by Senator McClain. This bill deals with charter school zoning and charter school facilities. It would preempt cities and counties from having any type of ordinance that when cars line up to pick up students at a charter school, if your city has an ordinance that dictates how these cars line up and the amount of cars that can line up to pick up the students, if the end result of that ordinance is limiting the school enrollment and not allowing the school to have the maximum number of students that they're allowed to have, then that those types of ordinance would be preempted under this bill. Additionally, the bill would say that that charter schools do not have to get any type of special exemption or conditional use approval in order to convert a charter school into an existing facility into a charter school. I would ask that if you could reach out to your planning staff, please share this bill with them and give us some feedback on those provisions. That would be extremely helpful. Last bill I wanted to mention briefly is in the House Housing, Agriculture, and Tourism Subcommittee on Tuesday. Representative Steele has a bill that's HB 665 that the League of Cities is opposed to. It deals with local government impact fees. These are two provisions in this bill that are similar to Senator McClain's bill I had mentioned earlier, but this one is much more targeted and much more limited. Essentially, it says that if you have impact fees and you try to raise impact fees, if you try to use the extraordinary circumstance exemption in state law now, it would only be applied if your city or county has essentially population growth up far above and beyond what was planned for. And so it would limit your ability to use that for things like, for example, rising construction costs, the cost of construction materials going above and beyond what you had planned for. You would not be able to use that. Lastly, it would have a prohibition on cities and counties requiring the installation of art or any art-related costs as part of approving a development. And so that is a summary on those three bills. And with that, I'll turn it over to Matt Singer.
Thank you, David, and good morning, everyone. The first bill I want to put on your radar will be heard this afternoon in the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee at 4 p.m. and is Senate Bill 1208 by Senator Truenow. And this bill relates to assessments and repairs on sewer service laterals. This bill would do a few things. First, it would create a 7-year window where cities would have to assess their sewer lines and laterals and repair any deficiencies within a year. So once discovering this, it would start a shot clock where you would have to repair anything you discover on that lateral within a year. And while the bill does provide some direction towards funding sources that are already existing, it doesn't create any new funding sources. And so we're working with the sponsor to try to refine this section and make sure that any mandates on cities inspecting this type of infrastructure is not only has funding provided, but has a scope that's actually feasible and would improve the situation back home. The House companion for that bill does have 4 committee references and has not been heard yet. And so we're working with the sponsors to try to refine both of these bills. The second bill I want to put on your radar will be heard tomorrow morning in the House Natural Resources and Disaster Subcommittee at 9 a.m. and is House Bill 1535 regarding emergencies by Representative McFarland. Currently, as it stands, this bill does not have a Senate companion. And this bill does a number of things and is comprehensive in nature. One thing this bill does that we like is it seeks to streamline and coordinate debris management at all levels of government, including addressing some issues with contracts and the rate setting of debris management vendors. We've seen a lot of issues in the past few storm seasons where local governments have been having to negotiate against one another to try to secure these contracts. And when it comes, push comes to shove, these vendors have been no-showing on contracts they've signed. This bill puts in an actual penalty for activity like this and would, apply a fine to a vendor that broke this contract. That's one good thing this bill does, but there are two main provisions that we're concerned of. And the first one would prohibit local governments from assessing an impact fee on any structure that's reconstructed of the same land use value. This doesn't contemplate any type of infrastructure impacts that would increase with a rebuilt structure that may be larger in size or have increased density or intensity. And so we're trying to work with the sponsor on this section to refine it and make sure it's better defined. There's one other provision in this section that you may remember from Senate Bill 180. And this section would place a moratorium on local governments being able to adopt land development or building permit regulations that are more restrictive or burdensome. This is language we've seen in a couple bills this year. and unfortunately is quite broad, and when paired with a cause of action in the bill, can lead to a lot of costly litigation over the uncertainty on what local governments can and cannot do in this area. And so we're working with the sponsor to try to refine both of these sections. Again, that's House Bill 1535, which will be heard tomorrow morning in the House Natural Resources and Disaster Subcommittee. And with that, I'll pass it to Rebecca O'Hara.
Good morning, everybody. I do not have a bill to speak to you about today that is on an agenda yet for this week, but I do want to put one thing on your radar, and that is the Enterprise Fund transfer issue and utility extraterritorial surcharge bills, specifically the Senate bill, which is Senate Bill 1704 by Senator Kalatayu. As I mentioned, these bills deal with all types of municipal utilities, and it would impose a 10% cap on how much revenue could be transferred from the utility enterprise funds to the city's general fund. It would also eliminate authority to impose a 25% surcharge on extraterritorial water and sewer service. The reason I'm bringing this bill up today is that its first committee of reference is the Senate Regulated Industries Committee. What I need you to do is, if you have a city with a utility and you are impacted by this bill, now is the time to start reaching out to members of the Regulated Industries Committee in the Senate and let them know about the impact this bill will have on your city. Starting with Chair Jennifer Bradley, the other members of the committee include Senator Pizzo, Senator Bernard, Senator Boyd, Senator Burgess, Senator Fine, Senator Gruters, and Senator Angolia. Please start contacting these senators. Let them know about the fiscal impact this bill will have on your city and on your utilities. Thank you. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Sam Wagner.
Good morning, everyone, and thumbs up for all y'all wearing green. Today, I got two bills for you. Senate Bill 110 and House Bill 1427. This is the Rural Communities Bill. Sponsors are Senator Simon, Representative Griffiths. We're monitoring these bills. The bill is the central priority of the Senate President. Last week, Senate Bill 110 passed out of its final Senate committee stop and is now headed to the floor. These bills modernize the support for fiscally constrained counties by updating definitions and increasing a fiscally constrained county threshold from $5 million to $10 million generated per mill in property tax revenue. It boosts the fiscally constrained county funding to at least $50 million annually and establishes new spending requirements for public safety, infrastructure, and other public purposes. There's approximately $119 million in funds allocated to various grants that are aimed at revitalizing rural communities. Our argument is simple. Any city that's within a fiscally constrained county should get direct funding. I anticipate this bill will be on the floor of the Senate on Wednesday. And as for the House, it has not been heard, and it will very likely move, and we will work to create a dedicated funding source for cities within fiscally constrained counties for that bill. For House, my second set of bills, House Bill 1211 and Senate Bill 1554, this is public safety by Representative Abbott and Senator Collins, respectively. We're opposed to these bills, 100%. The bill is a comprehensive reform of public safety in Florida. It requires the consolidation of all 911 call centers into the sheriff's office or the county by July of 2029. It requires vehicles closest to an incident to respond, creates a task force that will study the consolidation of all state law enforcement in Florida under the Department of Law Enforcement. There are four committee stops for the House bill in the House and the Senate. These bills have not been added to any agenda yet, but we will be watching very carefully for if and when they do. And with that, that is all that I have, and I'll pass it back to Casey Cook.
Thank you, Sam. All right, let's transition into question and answer portion of the call. If you'd like to ask a question, you'll press star 9, and then when you're recognized, state your name and your city. While we're waiting on questions to flow in, I do want to remind folks that next week is the Florida League of Cities Legislative Action Days, Monday through Wednesday of next week. We hope to see you in town. We have record attendance or folks signed up, looking forward to seeing everybody that's coming. If you're new, to the call, we'd encourage you to check out the Legislative Action Days. It's our day where we can flood the Capitol with city officials and really educate legislators on our message. Second is we have a Know Before You Go webinar tomorrow at 2 p.m. for those folks that are signed up for Legislative Action Days. It's a great way to get a head start on preparing for your meetings next week, hearing about the issues that we'll talk about, as well as some of the logistics for the event. So I see we have our first question coming in. So first question, fire away.
Yeah, hi, this is Susan Starkey, council member in Davie. How are you today?
I'm great, how are you?
Good, good.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm calling about, the question is about 1554. The closest unit response, does that require a study where it would give comparable cities reimbursements for those calls, or is it reciprocal? And if the cities don't have any way of kind of reciprocal trading of calls for service, wouldn't that prevent some cities from making the necessary improvements to their cities? So knowing that the other city will follow and be the closest unit?
Hey, councilwoman. So, just to make sure I understand your question, you're asking that is the bill to require a study for the individual units or emergency response that are closest to an incident? Is that the question?
Yeah, it requires a study that also allows for an amount of dollars if the city, as an example, last year we provided 14. Calls for service to Cooper City, and you know we work something out with them, but we don't reimburse them. They are on a credit for calls back to us. What we're concerned with down here is if there is a closest unit response and some cities don't make the necessary improvements going forward or providing adequate EMS or fire, then the other surrounding cities would end up being the closest unit response to responding to those. How do they get reimbursed for it if they're not basically doing their part, you know? Do they get reimbursed somehow?
Yes, ma'am. So to answer the question directly, no, the bill does not call for a study to determine reimbursement rates. And in reference to reimbursement rates, no city within the bill is allowed to opt out. The only individual in the bill as it's currently drawn up that's allowed to opt out will be a sheriff. And then if a sheriff opts out, a county would then take over that service. To answer your question directly, if a city does not provide that service or does not do the response as a first unit, it would either be the sheriff, who would be, from a police perspective, would either be the sheriff in that instance or the other closest individual city if there's a cop on duty or another emergency provider available. But the bill does not call for a study, and it requires all cities and counties to have a consolidated E911 by July of 2029.
Okay,
thank you for the question.
We have that.
And this is the...
But the real issue, and the firefighters and, you know, our first responders are going to help and respond. That's first and foremost for public safety, no matter where the boundaries are. The issue comes when some cities are not going to be able to afford or reimburse the cities who are helping and assisting.
Yep, absolutely. And that is one that is on our radar. I know that we've had some conversations with the Police Chiefs Association as well as the Fire Chiefs Association. Here's the good news on that one. There's four committee references on the House side, and the bill hasn't been heard yet. So I think we need to continue educating legislators on the challenges of moving to a consolidated dispatch operation. And this is one that I think has zombie potential, where if it doesn't make it this year, it's going to come back next year. And so for these zombie type bills, our job is to educate on why our current process or system is working and why these changes may have negative ripple effects that they haven't thought about. So it's one that we're monitoring. We'll keep you updated if it starts to move. Really appreciate the question. All right, next question.
Good morning. This is Mandrika from the Grand City of Midway, Florida. How's everyone doing?
It's another day in paradise. How are you doing, Mandrika?
I see. I'm doing well. So my question, I'm chimed in. I hear all of the bills that are being filed, and it's overwhelming. It is definitely overwhelming. So I would like some guidance as to, because I feel like it's just, if it's not one thing, it's another. How do you suggest, and I'm getting the emails, looking through the emails, how do you suggest as a council member or an elected official, we navigate the trenches? I know we have legislative session coming up, even in meeting with the individuals, and my plan this week is to attend some of the presentations this week, but what is your recommendation for us navigating all of these potential changes?
That's a great question. I really appreciate you asking it because, you know, you're not the only one that can feel overwhelmed with all of the bills that are out there. I mean, we have over 1,800 bills that have been filed. 900 were filed in the week before session. And it seems like everything, everywhere, all at once. My suggestion would be, of the bills we've talked about, to try to identify two or three. That prioritization is going to vary from city to city, but find two or three bills that have a direct impact on your city and focus on those. Get good information from your staff so that you can communicate an effective message to legislators. Because if everything's important, nothing's important. At the end of the day, it's challenging representing local governments because there are so many bills filed that impact our operations. I think you'll have to go through a prioritization process internally and then find those bills that have the biggest impact on your community and make sure you educate your legislators on it. You're doing everything we ask by dialing in on Monday morning phone calls, by going and reading the bill summaries, reading on tap that goes out every Friday afternoon, and then responding to alerts. Those are all important things. And, you know, if there is a bill that may not impact Midway, you know, you won't have great information to provide about it because it doesn't impact Midway. But find those bills that do and make sure you're in your legislators' ears because that's how we make a difference, and have a successful session. I really appreciate that question, Mandrika. Good one. All right, next question.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is President Michael C. Blake from the city of Cocoa, Florida. I just would like to thank everyone for participating in today's morning announcements pertaining to bill summary. Two things I would like to say. One is to educate ourselves, continue to educate ourselves, having this dialogue with our elected officials, our state legislatures, and also with the FLC, because we have a story to tell. And as you all are clearly aware of, a lot of these bills are technical. So please feel free to express your concerns with your staff members at your municipalities and also disseminate this information with the league. I do sincerely do appreciate everyone for this productive and rewarding morning. Job well done to Casey and staff and to all elected officials participating today, because you are the backbone of your community.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's always good to hear your voice, and we appreciate your leadership. And I think you hit on something, you know, very important there. You know, there's a lot of bills that are out there, but for those that impact your city, make sure you pass that feedback back to us, because the better data we have equals a better story that we can tell to legislators. And in many cases, bills are filed based on half-truths. And we have a voice too, and we deserve to tell our story. And oftentimes, it can completely change the conversation at the Capitol. But we can't do that unless we have information from you and the really good data and feedback that you give us. Thank you, Mr. President. Next question.
Good morning. This is Willie Puzz with the Solid Waste Authority of Palm Beach County. First, it's just, you know, thank you for the great job you do every year with your legislative coordination. Your team is wonderful. And this is a process question on the number of committee stops a bill sees. And three seems to be the standard, but there are some bills with two committee stops and others with four. Does this mean that a bill with two committee stops would intentionally put it on an easier path to pass, and four stops would make it harder to pass? Or is this just like happenstance? Thank you.
Willie, that's a really good question there. I think it depends on the presiding officer. So in theory, a bill gets filed and it's routed up to the Rules Committee and either the Senate President or the Speaker of the House. They have a conversation as to the number of area or subjects that that bill opens up, and they try to reference it to all of the committees that deal with that particular topic. Some bills have a lot of things in them, and so they may pick up an additional reference. But generally, it's, you know, 60 days is a short period of time if you think about our legislative session here. And it's hard enough to get a bill through three committees, let alone four. It's a whole lot easier to get a bill through two committees. So it could be as simple as the bill, in the eyes of the rules chair or the speaker, Senate president, only touched on, you know, a very limited scope, and that's why it only got two references. Or it could be a fan favorite, and they like the bill, and they want to make the process easier, and so they only gave it two references. The flip side also applies. If it's a big, complex bill, it may get referenced to four committees because it touches on a number of different things. Or maybe the speaker's office or the Senate president's office isn't a big fan of the issue, and they want to make the journey just a little bit tougher. But what we do know for a fact is that it is harder to pass a bill through four committees in 60 days as opposed to three or two. And that also helps us figure out, especially at about the week four mark, if a bill has four committee references and it hasn't moved, and reference two or reference three is a subcommittee, subcommittees typically stop around week four or week five. So if a bill is stuck in a committee that's no longer meeting, it's dead for the year unless something crazy happens. And so that is a good marker for us in, you know, which bills will have some momentum, or potentially which bills may have a harder journey ahead of them to passage. But it's something we use to determine how we spend our time and energy during session. That's a really good question, Willie. Thank you. Next question.
Hi, good morning, everyone. First, I just want to say thank you. It's Tracy Clary from the City of Hollywood. I had a question regarding David Cruz. You had mentioned the charter school, and it looks like the prior bill, the same bill number. Can you repeat those numbers first? Particularly the charter school.
Good morning. The charter school bill number is 1188 by Senator McClain.
Perfect. And then does that by any chance have any effect on pre-existing charter schools, or is that for all new?
The provision dealing with the vehicle pickups and the lines that they form and your city having an ordinance that might ultimately end up lowering the number of students that could enroll in that school, that would be applying to all schools currently. The other provision that would not require a charter school to obtain a special exemption or conditional use approval would deal prospectively for any type of charter school conversion in the future. So if you, for example, have a movie theater and a charter school wants to come in and turn that movie theater into a charter school, we've already been preempted in having to allow that, and this further preempts not requiring a special exemption or conditional use approval in that specific scenario.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm on my way up for Broward, Dave. Thank you so much. And then also, could you just update us on the CRA bill, where that's at? I didn't hear it earlier, so just wanted to make sure I'm not missing anything.
Yes, good morning, and thank you everybody for your advocacy on the CRA bills. Last week, the CRA bills moved in both the House and in the Senate. The House bill has one more committee of reference before reaching the House floor. The Senate bill has two more committees before it reaches the Senate floor. It was a particularly close vote in the Senate. It passed by a narrow margin of 4-3, and even one of the people that voted for that bill in the Senate debated against it. And so I thought that was a good sign in the Senate. I think certainly we have some friends there, so I would certainly continue your advocacy and education efforts as it relates to CRAs in both the House and in the Senate.
The other thing I'll add, and this is going back to Willie's question. Willie, I think that's a really good example of a bill where the intel we've gotten is that the Speaker's office may not be the biggest fans of CRAs, resulting in two references. You contrast that with the Senate bill. The Senate bill has the standard three references. And so I think we'll fight our fight here on the Senate side based on all of those factors. And thanks to all of your efforts, for those of you that have CRAs and are, you know, successfully revitalizing parts of your community, thank you for telling your story, because if you watch that committee meeting, I think it was evident that we had educated legislators, and I think it makes it that much harder for that bad bill to keep moving in the process. So appreciate everybody's efforts on the CRA front. All right, I see we have a couple more questions. Next question.
Hi, this is Sherry Simmons from City of DeBary. Question for you on Colatitude's Bill 1730. I see you're monitoring that. It's really kind of a companion bill to 943, and most damaging in 1730 is that it does expand Live Local to PUDs, which we believe is a violation of the state constitution. So I just wanted to hear why is it that we're just monitoring that? Because we're going up next week with y'all, and we're going to stringently fight against it. I know you can't oppose everything. I understand that. But that PUD amendment plus limiting commercial in mixed use to 10%. We have an ordinance we passed last year, 35%. So this is extremely damaging, especially to smaller cities. Thank you.
Hi, good morning. This is Rebecca O'Hara. A good question on the 1730. That's the Senate version of the revisions to the Live Local Act. The House companion is 943. The reason why we have a different position on the Senate bill than we do for the House bill is that the Senate bill is much more measured in the changes that it is making to Live Local. The House bill has a lot of really, really bad stuff in it. You can see from our bill summary that's online and compare the two, what a stark difference there is between the House bill and the Senate bill. Now, that's not to say that the Senate bill is perfect. We have submitted amendment suggestions to the bill sponsor and to others in the Senate that address your concern about PUDs, among other things, but it is a lot easier to negotiate changes to a bill when you are taking a lighter touch with it than a heavy hand. And so our opposition to the House bill and our position of monitor on the Senate bill is strategic. I hope that answers your question.
Okay. Could I see a copy of the amendments? Again, we're going up with y'all next week, so that would be helpful. And we're meeting with a lot of folks on this, and we know we're putting our appropriations in danger, but this will kill DeBary. So we just want to make sure we're all speaking the same language.
Yep. Or if you submitted, I can track down your email address.
Yeah. David has it. And Casey.
Okay.
Thank you.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. All right. Next question.
Jimmy Johnson, Village of Palm Springs. I believe this question is for Matt Singer. You were talking about the sewer lateral repairs. Can you expound on that and give me the bill number, because I missed that?
Good morning. Yes, sir. That is Senate Bill 1208, and the House companion for that bill is 1187. This is the first time that bill will be heard this session, and it's one of those that has reappeared and has been proposed by the sponsor in the past when he was in the Florida House. I met with Senator Truenow last week on this bill, and his intention here is to ensure that all of these sewer lines and laterals over the next decade or so are cleaned up and assessed so we know where the problem lies. He thinks that this is a dark hole where we just don't know where the issues are, and really wants all utility entities to start inspecting, assessing, and then begin repairing these leaking infrastructure. And so that bill will be heard this afternoon, and we're working with him and submitting some recommendations to try to refine that scope.
So he's focused on private sewer lateral repairs or sewer laterals from the property owners to the municipality connection?
He's focused on all of it, sir. He's focused on up from the private down to our sewer mains as well. And so there's certainly some private property issues in terms of liability, risks, and transparency that we're trying to share with him as well. It's the entire system, and not just public municipality utilities either. It's all utilities.
And Jimmy, the other thing I would add is, as you know, I know you're a subject matter expert here as a utilities director. You know, you and your peers are the ones that we need the good stories from, and some of the challenges that that's going to create for you and your, you know, in your day job. Those are the stories we need, because legislators, there aren't any, to my knowledge, that have been a utilities director before. And it's important that we get the information from the subject matter experts to the legislators so that they can make an informed decision.
Very good. Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you, sir.
All right, next question.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hi. Am I the next call?
Yes, ma'am.
Great. Hi, this is Lisa DeVito from Crescent City, small town in rural Putnam County. My question is about the Rebecca's bill. I believe it's 1704 that limits transfers from the enterprise funds to the city. We have sewer, gas, and water. We're a small town in a rural area. We provide gas in about a 10 to 15 mile radius, and we have people asking us to supply water and sewer in a developing area. Currently, we are not very profitable. My questions are two. Number one, does the cap on imposition of transfer of funds from the enterprise to the city budget, would that affect our payment of our enterprise funds? We pay administrative fees to the city for staff services. Would that be affected by this bill? And that makes a difference in what I say in advocacy.
Good morning, Lisa. This is Rebecca. I think that the language is not sufficiently clear as to whether those administrative costs could be included in the cap or excluded from the cap. I think it depends on how you read the sentence, and it is not clear. Our intent, of course, would be to exclude those cost allocations or administrative expenses from the cap. So that's what I would advocate for.
Okay, well, I certainly would like that. And of course, we don't particularly like in the future, if we become profitable, to have the other kind of limitation either. And the second thing is, regarding the surcharge for customers outside the municipal boundaries. In our situation, we have people potentially asking us to run lines and initiate service. So how would the cap on surcharges affect that situation? Could they pay us to run the lines, but then future revenue would be capped?
So I think you're mixing two different concepts. The cap,
yes,
which only applies to enterprise fund transfers, and then the surcharge, which is something completely different. The surcharge only applies to water and wastewater service, and it only applies when you're serving extraterritorial customers. The bill eliminates current authority for the 25% surcharge. So if have a practice now where you're imposing the surcharge, you would no longer be able to do that effective July 2026.
Okay, so I guess what I'm saying is that's exactly what I'm talking about. If we're being asked to run lines to extraterritorial new customers, can they pay us to run those lines? And then obviously after that, we would not be able to impose a surcharge.
You'd probably need to talk to your finance director and your utility director to confirm the specifics of that question, Lisa. But I don't think the surcharge imposition or the lack of the ability to impose a surcharge would affect your ability to recover the cost of the actual infrastructure to run lines. But again, that's a fairly detailed question that you would need to vet with your finance director and your utility director.
Okay, that really helps. Thank you very, very much.
Got it.
All right, next question.
Good morning, this is Sandy Golding from the city of Jacksonville Beach. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. While we are explaining the intricacies of how the legislature works, could you help us understand the situation where maybe there is no companion bill? That doesn't mean that bill couldn't still survive and maybe be sent to the House or the Senate to be, so it would still actually be a live bill. And likewise, if there are companion bills, just because one of the companions doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't mean that the other one couldn't be taken up by, say, the Senate or the House, correct?
So that's a great question, and I'm going to try to dive into the answer here. So the first, generally speaking, you need a House bill and a Senate bill. When there's a scenario where you have a House bill and no Senate bill, or a Senate bill and no House bill, the bill still could pass in a couple of different ways. One, just because there's not a currently filed House bill doesn't mean that they won't release a proposed committee bill later in the process. So instead of a bill that has a member's name at the end of it, this is a bill that has effectively been endorsed by a particular committee. Let's say it's the Intergovernmental Relations Subcommittee. They roll out a proposed committee bill in week 3 or week 4. The committee vets it, approves it, then it is given typically one additional reference and it's ready for the floor. So in that scenario, there would be no House bill, a PCB is introduced, and now there is a viable vehicle on that side. Now, another way that it could happen is that there could only be a Senate bill, and the Senate bill passes all the way through the process. It's transmitted to the House in what we call messages, and then the House takes it up. That rarely happens. There would have to be, I think, an extraordinary circumstance for that to happen. So the third answer is that, yes, if there's only a Senate bill, typically that's a really good sign that, you know, that bill may not have life for the year. And it could be as simple as either the House or Senator, the House member or the Senator that filed the bill couldn't get anybody on the other side to say yes. But it's our job in our meetings to gather intel to see if we can get an idea of whether we need to put our tinfoil hats on and worry about a proposed committee bill, or if it's as simple as, you know, that last solution where the Senate sponsor couldn't convince anybody in the House to say yes. I think it's a really good process question. You're not out of the woods just because there's not a House companion or a Senate companion, but it's our job to gather as much intel as we can so that if a proposed committee bill is released, we'll know it's coming and we've already educated the members of that particular committee as to why it's a good or bad piece of legislation. Thank you for the question.
Yeah, thank you so much, Casey.
All right. Yes, ma'am. All right, last question. Last question going once. I hear you. All right. Well, we hope to catch up with you on the next call. That's the end of this week three legislative call-in. Please stay close to your devices. We have a busy week ahead. We look forward to seeing you in town next week for Legislative Action Days, and we will hear you on our next Monday morning call-in next Monday at 9 a.m. Thank you all for what you do, and stay close to your devices and respond when we send out an alert. Have a good week. Happy St. Patrick's Day.